Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thank you for showing up. Glad you're here. Let's talk about some shit.
How are you doing?
What's new? How's life? Work? Kids? All the above? Sometimes it's hard to ask people those questions. I mean, it's easy to do them in a light way when you're just trying to fill empty conversation or fill space and, like, oh, look at the weather outside. How are you doing? What's that over there? You know, it can be a empty conversation versus an honest attention when we ask somebody how they are. And I've often found myself in the space when I do ask and I start to get a response, I'll feel uncomfortable because I don't know how to hold the other person's feelings honestly. And so I try to be very careful and I try to have my inner reasons in line when I ask somebody that question. But I guess my point in even bringing that up is just to say that I've been thinking a lot about sincerity, like what it means to be sincere and how that relates to our relationships with others. I've had a lot of new employees coming in. I've been training more. And one of the people that I've been training is, she's interesting. I like her, honestly. But we have a very different personality types. Like, I was trying to talk to her about meditation, and she literally said, "That sounds like the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I would never do nothing." You know, like, and I was just like, well, I spend, hours of my week, practicing nothing. But I still think there's something of value that me and this person can still learn from each other. And I enjoy her presence and her difference. And a lot of the times I'll say things and she'll add on additional context and almost perceive an extra bit to what I was saying. And I don't know, I'm not describing it very well. And I always have to say, well, I'm an incredibly sincere person. I meant exactly what I said to you. And that's exactly what I meant. There's no additional addendum to this. I wasn't criticizing you. I wasn't being sarcastic. Like, I don't have a sarcastic reader in my head, honestly. Like, it's really hard for me to keep the sarcasm meter going. So to a point of overdoing it constantly, I overread into and overanalyze every situation for how and what I intend to say. And sometimes this can bite me in the ass. But through this, I've been able to cater a breed of attention for myself and for my work and for my loved ones and for everything that I'm intending to do. And my intentions have been haphazardly all over the place lately. There's been a lot of big changes coming into my life, and I've had to do a lot of thinking about what I am and what I can do. And those things are intrinsically connected because your formal makeup, like your skill set, your strength, things that make you who you are bound to what you can do. And that sounds dumb, like duh, common sense. But still, I think it's an important thing to say and to think about, and to really get the point of what that even means. Analyze every action you do today and see how exhausting it is to just stay on top of it. We do so many things that are just like autopilot, or it's so difficult to stay in attention. And when you have all these changes coming in and you have this method for your life, for how you decided to live, it can throw a lot of like wrenches into the gears. And sometimes you have to re-oscillate and find your balance again. So I want to read something I wrote about a week ago. This is how I was feeling about the situation. Lots of change in the cards, as is natural in life. But resistance in the form of knuckles clenched around this moment is unnatural. But it is not the actual moment. That one's infinite, and it's never going anywhere, anyhow. But what do you mean? Presently living is Wu Wei, flowing, in the act of being a person, restricting yourself to complacency due to a false sense of normalcy. That is insane. Trying to hold a moment still by brute force. Willing existence not by the universe's wise wisdom, but by our own minuscule viewpoint's idea of what reason is. I don't need to force things. I need only listen and respond. Yin is understanding, open-hearted awareness to the needs of the moment, attention, carefully finding the middle way's right effort. The response is yang impregnated with yin's purpose, which can never be lived unless we step out of our roles and into awareness. Now, I've gotten really deep into the word natural and what naturality is, and, you know, and my use of the word unnatural in this little blurb is already grating against me because of all the things I said last week or 2 weeks ago, and I took a week off. But I still like what I meant behind it, because when we have changes coming in and when it's all the novelty of newness of our new approach, we have to be flexible and fluid and ready. And to try to use strength or force to resist this change, and that could be in the action of not wanting it to be, of wanting badly to stay still and to stay in the presence, which is the goal anyway, right? We're always trying to stay present. But last week's presence is no longer presence, and that's the real fuckaroo about this whole situation. And that's the conundrum that always gets me scratching my head, because presence is constantly changing. And in Buddhism, they had a word for reality. And I can't remember it right now, so I'm not going to try to. But basically, reality was void. And not void as in nothing, but void as in permanent. Because permanence and stagnance is what makes us think that things exist anyways. And that could be our own emotional setting, or it could be the physical world setting. And of course, they're intrinsically bound together. They're not separate in any way, shape, or form. So my change that I've been wrestling with is the fact that I'm losing a lot of my government welfare. I lost my medical insurance, which is weird for me because I've had Medicaid, which is a socialized state form of insurance, since I was 18. And I was even on Medicaid when I was a child. And so for anybody who's not familiar with this concept, which I'm sure a lot of you are on social insurance, it's basically like the government pays a portion of my medical costs, and I have a very like small co-payment. Like, I had a surgery done several years back and I paid $5 for it, you know, and it was probably thousands of dollars. But I've always had this assistance for all of my living life, and I'm finally at a point where I make too much money, even though it sounds oxymoronic because they're saying I make too much money, but I can't afford food, you know, and then I can't get welfare for food, and then I also can't go to the doctor anymore, you know? Like, so it's just this very scary feeling, and from that has grown a strange sense of pity for the situation. But there's another feeling buried beneath that pity that I have found far more compelling. And that's the one I would like to describe to you. In a way, I kind of feel like the universe, like if this is a schoolroom, and the world, you know, God, Brahma, or whatever abstract concept you want to interpose there, you could call it nature, reality, How about just something as vague as what is it? But I'm trying to have a relationship with this thing, and that's a major form of my spiritualism, is me listening and trying to give and take and having a functional relationship with the world. And in a way, for a large portion of my life, I've been in this naivety, and it's because of my natural ignorance as I'm growing. I'm a philosophical infant. And especially when I was a child, it's almost like I was philosophically unborn in a way, And so it's like the teacher position of the universe is slowly starting to become less of an authority figure in a way, kind of. When you have the need for authority figures, you require assistance. And when the government's helping me, it's because something I've had to ask for help, or something's come into a place to fill a hole where I cannot do it for myself. And this comes from a place of weakness almost, but not like weakness as like a pitiable thing. It's natural, just like a child is weak, right? But now it almost appears as if my training wheels are being removed. And the bumpers at the bowling alley are being taken down. The safety measures that have lubricated my glide through life, they're being removed. And the colossal leap financially that I have to make in order to support us is phenomenal and terrifying. And it's not a raise. I could get a $5 raise today, and I would be no closer really to being able to take over medical costs or childcare or even food. And I could be angry, and I felt that anger and been like, how dare you not help me, right? But and I do feel like if there's any population of people in my country, it's people like me, single parents with two rooms that I'm trying to pay for and support everything in my household with no partner. I still feel honestly like if there's a group of people who needs help, it's me. But at the same time, I respect it. And I have a strange sense of pride as I look at my situation now, and I'm trying to figure out what my next steps are and what I'm going to do to be able to do this. Because what I'm doing right now isn't going to work. Change is in the cards. I have a lot of changes that I have to implement. I have to change my career. I have to maybe change my home. I have to change my lifestyle. I certainly have to change the way that I've thought about my situation and what I can do and my potency, right? Change is everywhere. I've had a lot of change at work too. Like, artificially, the leaders in my business, the owner and my manager, have decided that I need to do less. And I choke on this because for me, the most important thing to do while on job is to get the job done. And I don't mind working harder than others and carrying people to get the job done. But if artificially I'm told not to do my job, and then the stress grows from there, it just makes no sense. And so I have new people in my business, and the idea, philosophically from leadership, is that these new people have to do the job. They're being hired, they have expectations, and they have to get it done. At the same time, I've been there for almost 2 years, over 2 years now. But in a way, I think this is a mistake that I've made. But I've been willing. And so now the expectations for anybody coming into the business is to do what I do. And I am a high energy individual. And it's taken me a long time to understand that other people may not be able to do what I do. Most people can. And so now I'm being told to do less because other people are expected to do what I used to do. And this has just been stressing me the hell out. So all these things are supposed to help me, but I hate it. All I want to do is just do my job. And I don't mind if I have to work 10 times harder than anybody else. But this is a new paradigm. And because of me trying to stranglehold a sameness still, you know, just not in my personal life anymore, I've been stressing myself out, man. Like, and honestly, just got to figure out how to shenangle the newness. How do we shenangle the newness? Like, man, I wish this was more of a dialogue. I would really love at this point in the conversation to ask you personally, like, what do you think? What, where is your new change? Like, here's the trippy part. It's not about you. Change is effervescent. Change is part of God. Change is part of nature. And guess what? You are part of nature. You are part of God. You are part of this isness and this world. And so guess what that means? You are changing every minute. This idea of consistency is mythology. A useful myth that can be taken and made valuable, certainly. But don't be deluded to think that that is the rules of life. Don't expect that to be the road that you're going to walk on this whole entire time. Now, I've been racking my brain about what I could do to become more adaptable. Adaptation, you know. How can I be who I am? Because it's going to happen whether I want to or not. Whatever my mind decides is happening. What are the needs of the moment? This brings up one of my favorite words, listening. How can we find our place in the moment? What's the best thing I could do right now? This morning, my son had a friend stay over last night. It was his first sleepover. I think it went pretty well. I don't like being in my bed all night, which I was in my room the whole time because I gave them the living room, which is okay. But this morning, I was in my reading stage. The boys got up early and started playing games. And I had this weird tension and ambivalence. And in hindsight, I think mainly it's because this is a brand new novel experience, having a strange neighbor child in my house and learning how we're going to play this morning. It's a new, brand new morning. And one of the things I did this morning that I think is going to be like placeable, like something I want to do every time, is I made them all breakfast. I remember my dad doing similar things when I'd have friends over. And the reason I did it was because I felt called to do it. And I make Odin breakfast anyway, but I made him a big breakfast. I made pancakes and I made eggs and I cut them kiwis and I got them water. I spent some time on it and I was involved in it when I did it. And I felt good about it when I did it. And that's adaptation. I didn't wake up and have a plan. When I made this schedule, I didn't say, I'm going to do this in the morning. I didn't make it a routine yet. It's not a routine yet. It's the first time. But I was listening and I thought, this is what I should do right now. And I did. And that might be a vague example. I don't know if that's going to exactly get across what I'm trying to say. But I think it's enough. I want to cross into some of my readings now. I recently finished Plato's Republic, and that was a great book. And the ending moved me. And I want to kind of tell a story, summarizing a rough paraphrase loosely of what Plato's ending was. And basically, he's describing the death cycle and what happens to a soul after it dies in his theory. And roughly, it's parable. So I'm sure that there's metaphor within it. It's not a strictly real idea. It's not like he thought this is exactly what was going to happen to us. Just like I think that there's metaphor and parable in the Tibetan Book of the Dead and other ritualistic books for these in-between places. The Psychedelic Experience by Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert is another great example. It's a manual that could be used for the in-betweens during life instead, since it's hard to practice death more than once. I guess most of us do it more than once, but in this cycle, I don't know. I'm shocked at how far I've moved in my own belief systems, but something happens to this essence. And whether intelligence completely dies with the body, which I think still could be, I think there's a lot more to life than just our reason and our ration and the intellect. There's a mass of infinite space in all of us. And in that space, I think, is forever. And there's something that happens to our spark afterwards. And maybe there's a continuity to the whole thing. Maybe there's not. To say it has or hasn't is to put a label on it and is to intellectualize it anyways. Anyhow, Plato said that when we die, all the souls end up in this like giant cave, basically, kind of like Hades. I'm assuming he's pulling from some of these pantheistic myths of Zeus and Poseidon, and So in this massive cave, there's two entrances into tunnels leading out of the cave. One's going up, one's going down. And the good people get to go up, and the bad people get to go down. And people are suited with pleasure, or they're suited with retribution for their decisions in life. And it's all part of this learning system where people have to have an effect for their cause. It's, to me, it reeks of karma, of consequence, whereas karma is not consequence, but maybe we have to carry our strong-held attachments and say we have an attachment to greed. What's to say that our essence won't carry greed into that in-between space? And maybe that could be a form of its own hell as it manifests in our own reality that we're making for ourselves. Anyways, Plato's cave. He describes how the sinners, I'll call them sinners because Christians and Christianity seems to be the best example I have for this sort of system, this heaven-hell concept. And keep in mind, this is 500 years before Jesus, 500 years before Christendom, 650 years reality before the Roman Catholic Church gets a hold out of it and starts to take the organization and promise retribution and salvation, which I don't think was Jesus's take anyways. But with this heaven and hell concept, this is blatantly what I see in Plato's work. And you can see remnants of this judgment, let's say. You have judgment in the Egyptian gods too, with I think it was Anubis with the scales and the giant crocodile god that would eat you if your scales did not weigh out against a feather, where all of your decisions are weighed. There's this judgment process. So this is inherent in a lot of belief systems, and I'm not saying that is necessarily mine, but I still find it interesting, and I can't help it. And so Plato describes people who come back from the sinning cave. If they try to leave too early, the cave would swallow them back down. And so this retribution is outside of our own self-will for what that is. It's not our own judgment of ourselves. It's this external judgment. And I think this would be allocated to the formal idea of virtue or truth for Plato. And so after we serve our dues and after heaven and hell, we come back. And once we come back to the cave, Plato describes the floor being littered with lots. And my brain, just to use an image from my modern life. I see these lots as ID cards. So just imagine a bajillion ID cards from all the different states and all the different countries and all the different municipalities of the world, just littered across this cave floor. And all the souls come up or down from their chosen place of judgment, and they come back into this cave to pick their new lot in life. And so Plato distinctly says that there's more options on the floor than there are people to choose. This is important because this means that people don't have to fight about it. There's so many choices that you could have anything you want. You could choose anything for your next life, and it's your choice. And he describes how people who might have lived very virtuous, good lives in their lives before might pick a lower life because they're tired of the tension of holding themselves so taut that they might choose the life of a sinner just to feel the laxness. And how somebody who might have lived a very poor life and made poor decisions, that might be the best candidate to choose a holy soul or a world mover or a revolutionary. So it's not exactly as cold, like you do bad, you're going to end up in hell forever. Yeah, you're going to have to go through karma and you will pay your dues, but you come back and it is your choice when you make a new life. And that's directly from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Because towards the end of the last bardo, we're said to have a lot of choice and decision on where we choose to go. And the idea in enlightenment is choosing emptiness, choosing void, saying, I don't want to be part of this anymore. I'm going to step out. But when you have greed and you have all these compulsions and attachments, that's what draws us back into old decisions. And that could be relevant even in our own little waking lives. Like, think about how all the past decisions pave your new decisions now. But we have every choice right now, here, right here, to make ourselves anything that we want to be. I could go choose to be completely different right now and be a completely different person tomorrow because this identity is impermanent. Everything is floating freely. And it's freeing to see how decision-making can do the same thing. All right. One last little blurb before I'll go do a couple quotations is I recently joined a men's group here in Colorado. It's actually pretty local here in Colorado Springs, which is where I live. Prop 122 passed last year, so there's a lot of psychedelia research going on, guiding meditations, outreach groups, retreats, medical centers, all kinds of shit's happening. It's lovely. It's like a renaissance. So I had a friend of mine who was talking about wanting to start a spiritual group for men because most of the spiritualism is women driven, and there's just a lot more females in this world than there are men. And as soon as he said this, he was lambasted. People called him a misogynistic prick, an asshole, all kinds of shit. Like, don't men have everything already? Why do you need anything else? But there was a point in what he was saying, and so he went and he started a group. The group is called Walking Each Other Home. Most of it's older men. I'm one of the younger people in there, but not saying there's more younger people. But because of the age difference, a lot of these people are much more professional and business-minded. And since a lot of these people are in the psychedelic industry or growing industry or trying to be part of it, we all have these like-minded passions. And it's been really cool just to talk with all these people and having community. In Buddhism, you have this idea of satsang or sangha, which is the spiritual community. And that's something I want to leave you with this morning, this Sunday morning on the cusp of winter, right after the amazing solar eclipse that we had yesterday. I want you to think about your community, and I want to think about how you could be part of making a community. And it doesn't have to be a large one, but you're not alone. And being part of these things has helped me tremendously to give me a sense of composure and connection. and just not to feeling like I'm talk about all this shit. At least in my life, not a lot of people are directly involved in a lot of these things I'm talking about. And it's fun to have other people like that. So I really appreciate you showing up, and thank you for listening to my rant. I'm gonna go grab a couple quotes and then we'll go get, I'll sign out. I'm just so grateful to have this opportunity, like always. Thank you, thank you, thank you, especially if you got to this part of the show. You're a lovely being, and I'm so grateful that you woke up and took a breath this morning. So firstly, I'm probably going to talk a lot more about this next week because his essay has been really moving me, but I want to finish the last one and have a much more concise idea of what he's trying to say before I present it. But here's John Stuart Mill. This is from his essay, Utility of Religion. Here it goes. Human existence is girt round with mystery. The narrow region of our experience is a small island in the midst of a boundless sea, which is at once awesome to our feeling and stimulates our imagination by its vastness and its obscurity. To add to the mystery, the domain of our earthy existence is not only an island in infinite space, but also in infinite time. That was John Stuart Mill. Next, this is Rumi. Maybe you are searching among the branches for what only appears in the roots. Next, I want to read something I wrote. I can feel a feeling, a weird emotion or vibe, and keep on keeping on. You have to give a feeling a scent in order for it to have control, or for it to take it. But what does that even mean? From my current evocation of me, I see options. I am calm. No, that's not quite right. I am no feeling. Not an emptiness, but a fullness embedded in potential. Before the attachment to an outcome, maybe I just don't have a word for it, but contentment comes close without complacency. Now I give license to this ambiguous tension, born of temporality, necessity, and chance. Wouldn't it be easy to unleash, to allow self and respect to rest? Running freely through my mind, locking the doors to reason and to attention. Thick blinders made from fragments of tunnel vision. Yet I can also stay in awareness, right here. This witness seems to take up infinite space, in which no other lesser emotional spark could ever hope to cover. I am so grateful to be right here, and hopefully now you are right here with me, at least for a little bit. Lastly, I want to read you an Upanishad. So, an Upanishad is an old Vedantic text. It's a book of Veda, which is old Hindu scriptures. And this one was moving for me. And it basically has a description of the anatomy of our being, not just the physical anatomy. This is the teaching of the sage Angra. Purusha manifests itself in three ways, as outer, inner, and the supreme self. Skin, flesh, vertebral column, hair, fingers, toes, nails, ankles, stomach, navel, hips, thighs, cheeks, eyebrows, forehead, head, ears, arms, sides, blood vessels, and nerves. These all make up the outer self. The inner self perceives the outside world, made up of earth, water, fire, air, and space. It is the victim of likes and dislikes, pleasure and pain, and delusion and doubt. It knows all the subtleties of language, enjoys dance, music, and all the fine arts, delights in the senses, recalls the past, reads the scriptures, and is able to act. This is the mind, the inner self. The supreme self, adored in the scripture, can be realized through the path of yoga, subtler than the banyan seed, subtler than the tiniest grain. Even subtler than the hundred thousandth of a hair. This self cannot be grasped and it cannot be seen. The supreme self is neither born nor dies. It cannot be burned, moved, pierced, cut, nor dried. Beyond all attributes, the supreme self is the eternal witness, ever pure and indivisible and uncompounded, far beyond the senses and the ego. In him conflicts the expectation sees. He is omnipresent, beyond all thought, without action in the external world, without action in me or my internal world. Detached from the outer and the inner, this supreme self purifies the impure. That was the Atma Upanishad. So thank you for letting me share those with you. I'm gonna go grab O.
Hello, it's Ask O.
What up?
Well, how are you guys were doing?
Please don't touch those things. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Cool. What'd you do last night?
Well, I had a sleepover with my friend.
What was that like?
That was pretty fun. Yeah, it was pretty fun.
Tell me about it.
Well, last night we played games till it was like the very last of the night. Not like the very last of the night when we had to go to bed. Yeah, then my friend slept in the couch and somehow he still had a good sleep. And I slept in my bed. And we both had a good sleep. And
cool. Did you have fun?
Yeah.
I'm glad you had fun.
Well, that might be it today.
Please stop. Thank you. All right. Well, I appreciate you coming, buddy.
Yep. And bye.
Love you.